Imagine for a second that you are a detective.
Okay, I'm following.
And you have been called to the scene of this massive explosive fire. But, well, there's a huge catch here.
Which is?
You are arriving billions of years after the fire actually happened.
Oh, wow. That is quite a delay.
Right. All you are allowed to examine are the cold, scattered ashes and, whatever faint trace of heat might still be lingering in the area.
Honestly, it feels like we should be completely locked out of that history. I mean,
Exactly.
you would just assume the sheer scale and age of the universe would have erased all that evidence.
But it hasn't. And welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are looking at a fascinating lecture by Perry Phillips on the Big Bang.
Specifically focusing on the universe's elemental abundance and the cosmic microwave background radiation.
Yeah, or to stick with our detective metaphor, we're analyzing the cinders and the glowing embers of the universe's
I
creation.
like that analogy.
Thanks. The goal of this deep dive is to shortcut your way to being scientifically well-informed. We are going to explore how known, everyday Earth physics-like, the stuff we can test in a lab today, allows us to confidently map out the first 3 minutes of the universe.
And we often hear the Big Bang discussed as this abstract origin story, you know. But Phillips frames it as a highly robust model anchored by what he calls a threefold cord of observable evidence.
Meaning it's not just a wild guess.
Far from it. We're looking at a physical event that left highly specific, measurable fingerprints all around us.
Okay, let's unpack this because I feel like we should start with the tangible stuff, right? The physical cinders.
The elements.
Yeah. If the universe began as this unimaginably hot, dense point, what physical materials were actually forged in that initial explosion?
Well, only the absolute lightest elements on the periodic table.
Like, how light are we talking?
The lightest. The math shows the Big Bang primarily produced hydrogen, helium, deuterium, which is just hydrogen with an extra neutron and a tiny microscopic trace of lithium.
So no heavy stuff at all.
None. If you were hoping to find early traces of carbon or oxygen or iron, you'd be entirely out of luck.
So it was just a universe filled entirely with balloon gas.
I mean, essentially, yes. And the crucial factor here is the extremely narrow timeline.
What do you mean?
Well, these elements didn't just form continuously as the universe expanded. There was a highly specific window where things could actually happen.
How specific?
Between exactly 100 seconds and 3 minutes after the Big Bang. That was the only time the conditions were right for atomic nuclei to fuse.
Okay, I have to push back on this right out of the gate.
Go for it.
Claiming to know what was happening exactly 100 seconds after the beginning of time? I mean, that sounds like a massive leap of faith. How can scientists possibly know that? Isn't that just guesswork?
No, it's a fair question. That skepticism is entirely warranted until you reframe how we think about temperature.
Okay, how so?
In physics, temperature is simply a measurement of particle speed. It's kinetic energy.
Right, hotter things move faster.
Exactly. By knowing the physics of how particles behave at specific temperatures, we can calculate the exact window where they move fast enough to fuse, but cool enough not to be blasted apart.
Blasted apart by what?
By photons. Highly energetic light particles. Before that 100-second mark, the universe was simply too hot.
Like too chaotic.
Way too chaotic. It was a soup filled with these highly energetic photons zipping around like microscopic wrecking balls. Anytime a proton and neutron tried to bond together, boom! A high-energy photon would instantly smash into them and blast the pair apart.
Oh, I see. So the heat is so intense that nothing can stick.
Right. But as the universe rapidly expands, it cools.
And so the photons lose their wrecking ball intensity.
Precisely. At 100 seconds, the universe cools just enough that those photons no longer have the kinetic energy required to blast nuclei apart.
And that's when the elements can form.
Yes, deuterium and helium can finally survive. But that window only stays open for about a minute and 40 seconds.
Wait, really? Only a minute and 40
Yeah,
seconds.
after 3 minutes, the universe becomes too cool.
Okay, I have an analogy for why that lower temperature limit matters.
Let's hear it.
Think about holding two incredibly strong magnets by their wrong ends, like both north
Oh,
poles.
sure. They push away from each other.
Right, as you push them together, you physically feel that electrical repulsion fighting you. But imagine you covered the ends of those magnets in heavy-duty, fast-acting superglue.
Okay.
If you just slowly press them together, the magnetic repulsion keeps them apart and the glue never touches.
Because you aren't pushing hard enough.
Exactly. But if you take those magnets and just smash them together at top speed, you overcome that invisible barrier for a split second. The superglue makes contact and it takes over. they permanently snap together.
That perfectly illustrates the battle between the electromagnetic force and the strong nuclear force.
So the strong nuclear force is the superglue.
Yes. It is intensely powerful, but it only operates at extremely close subatomic distances.
So to get two positively charged protons close enough for that superglue to take over,
you have to hurl them at each other with immense speed to overcome their natural electrical repulsion.
Which means you need high temperatures.
Exactly. Temperature provided that necessary speed. But after 3 minutes, the universe had cooled down too much.
The particles were simply moving too slowly to overcome the magnets, so to speak.
Exactly. The window for creating new elements slammed shut.
So any helium that was going to be created by the Big Bang had to be manufactured in that exact 1 minute and 40 second window. That is wild.
It is. But the beautiful part of theoretical physics is that you can't just claim this. You have to prove it.
Right. There has to be evidence.
And that proof comes from comparing the mathematical prediction to the astronomical observation. Physicists calculated the density and temperature of that specific window.
And what did they predict?
They predicted that roughly 1/4, 25% of the universe's early mass should have fused into helium.
Which is what? About 1 in every 12 particles?
Roughly, yeah. So to verify this, astronomers pointed their telescopes deep into space, peering at the oldest, most unpolluted gas clouds in the universe.
Because, just to remind you listening, light takes billions of years to reach our telescopes. So looking deep into space is quite literally looking backward in time.
Right. You are seeing the universe as it was, like the Hubble Deep Field.
And what did they find?
By measuring the spectral signatures of those ancient primordial clouds, they found exactly a 8.25 mass ratio of primordial helium.
A flawless match.
An exact match with the chalkboard math.
That has to be the ultimate mic drop for a physicist.
Oh, absolutely.
And speaking of those physicists, the history behind that paper is actually pretty funny.
The Alpha, Beta, Gamma paper.
Yes. So George Gamow and Ralph Felfer wrote this groundbreaking paper outlining this exact model. But Gamow was notoriously playful.
He was a bit of a jokester.
Yeah. He realized their last names sounded like Alpha and Gamma. So he specifically recruited Hans Bethe, a highly respected physicist, just to add his name to the authorship.
Even though Bethe contributed absolutely nothing to the actual research.
Nothing at all. He simply agreed to be a co-author so the publication could be famously immortalized as the Alpha, Beta, Gamma paper.
I love that. Even when unlocking the literal origins of reality, scientists still find time to commit to a good bit.
Truly. Okay, so that establishes the physical cinders, the incredibly precise ratio of hydrogen and helium. But an event of that magnitude isn't just a matter factory, right?
No.
It's an unimaginably massive release of energy. So where did the incredible energy and heat from that initial moment go?
And that leads us to the second major pillar of evidence, the cosmic microwave background radiation, or the CMBR.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the term Big Bang was actually coined as an insult.
Right, by Fred Hoyle.
Yeah, he hated this theory so much that he called it a Big Bang on a radio broadcast as a pejorative, just to make it sound cartoonish and absurd.
Which is incredibly ironic.
Right, because space is a vacuum. There's no medium for acoustic waves to travel through, so the Big Bang was completely 100% silent.
It was a silent, rapid expansion of space-time itself.
Right.
But, and this is key, it was definitely not dark.
Far from it.
Right. Gamow, Alpher, and Robert Herman predicted that the intense, blinding light from the early universe wouldn't just vanish.
It had to go somewhere.
Yes. They predicted that as space itself expanded, it would physically stretch the wavelengths of those original high-energy Big Bang photons.
So you take a tight, energetic, squiggly wave of light, and you just pull the ends apart.
Exactly. You pull it until it flattens out into a long, low-energy wave.
Like a microwave.
Yes. Over 14 billion years, that light was stretched so far that it shifted completely out of the visible spectrum down into the microwave spectrum with wavelengths of about 1 centimeter. What's fascinating here is how this loops back to your initial campfire analogy.
Oh, the detective looking at the ashes.
Right. Phelps points out that if you want to know if a campfire was recently burning, but you are forced to stand 100 feet away in the pitch black,
you can't see the flames.
Exactly. So instead, you use a thermal sensor to look for the specific spectrum of heat radiating off the nearby stones.
Ah, I see.
The CMBR is essentially the warm campfire stones of the early universe. They predicted this radiation would blanket the sky uniformly.
And the way humanity actually found this radiation is, without a doubt, one of my absolute favorite accidents in the history of science.
The pigeon poop discovery.
Yes. Fast forward to 1964. Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson are working at Bell Labs in New Jersey.
They've got this massive 50-foot horn-shaped antenna.
Right, and they aren't cosmologists looking for the Big Bang. They are just radio astronomers trying to bounce signals off the Echo Balloon satellite.
They were just trying to improve communication networks.
But to do that, they needed a completely quiet background to calibrate their sensitive equipment.
But they couldn't get one.
No. No matter where they pointed this giant horn in the sky, they kept getting this maddening low-level static, just a persistent uniform hiss from every direction.
Like a static sea sound.
Exactly. And they try everything to eliminate it. They check for radar interference from nearby New York City. They test the power lines.
They even climbed inside the giant antenna horn itself.
Right, and they discover a flock of pigeons has been nesting in the equipment.
Which led to them physically scrubbing out what they politely referred to in their logs as a, quote, white dielectric substance.
Which is an incredibly clinical way of saying they spent hours scraping pigeon poop out of an antenna.
Because they thought the biological waste was interfering with the radio waves.
But even after the antenna was spotless, the hiss was still there. It didn't fluctuate with the seasons, it didn't change when they pointed the horn at the sun, and it was coming from every direction in the sky simultaneously.
Because they had unknowingly tuned their antenna directly into the afterglow of the universe's birth.
They were listening to the CMBR. But, and Phillips clarifies a really counterintuitive detail about this light in the lecture, which we should mention.
The delay.
Yeah. The radiation hitting Penzias and Wilson's antenna wasn't from the literal fraction of a second beginning of the Big Bang.
No, it was from 300,000 years later.
Right. So why is there a 300,000-year delay on the flash?
Well, to understand that delay, we have to picture the cosmic fog.
Cosmic fog.
Yeah. For the first 300,000 years, the universe was still intensely hot. It was a massive plasma.
Okay, so just energy and particles flying everywhere.
Right. The electrons couldn't settle into orbits around the hydrogen and helium nuclei. They were roaming freely. And free electrons have a very large scattering cross-section for light.
Which basically means they act like tiny erratic mirrors bouncing light in every direction.
Exactly. Think about turning on your car's high beams in a dense, heavy fog.
Oh, the light doesn't penetrate. It hits the water droplets, scatters backward, and creates a blinding white wall.
Yes. The early universe was an opaque, blinding wall of scattering plasma.
So the light couldn't travel?
Not in a straight line, no. Not until the ambient temperature dropped to the magic number.
Which was?
Around 3,000 Kelvin. At that temperature, about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, the kinetic energy of the universe finally drops enough that the free electrons are captured by the atomic nuclei.
So they form stable, neutral atoms.
Precisely. And when that happens,
the fog lifts.
Instantly, on a cosmic scale, with the electrons bound to atoms, space became transparent. The photons finally had a clear path to travel in straight lines.
And that massive simultaneous release of light from the clearing fog, that is what has been traveling through expanding space for 14 billion years.
Stretching out the whole way into microwaves.
Wow. And didn't a satellite eventually map this out?
Yes. By the late 1980s, NASA launched the COBE satellite to measure this radiation from space above the interference of our atmosphere.
And what did it find?
It found the background temperature to be roughly 2.75 Kelvin, perfectly matching the exact thermal Planck curve predicted decades earlier.
Okay, so we have the cinders, the exact 25% ratio of helium. And we have the embers, the microwave background radiation.
Right.
But that leaves a massive elephant-sized hole in the narrative. We establish that the Big Bang only created balloon gas.
Hydrogen, helium, a little lithium, no heavy elements at all.
So where did the rest of the periodic table come from?
That is a great question.
If the Big Bang didn't make the building blocks of life, what did? How did we get the carbon in our DNA, or the oxygen we breathe, or the iron in our blood?
Well, all of that heavy lifting was entirely outsourced to stars.
Stars?
Through a process called stellar nucleosynthesis.
Okay, break that down for us.
So a star is fundamentally a delicate, ongoing battle between two unimaginably powerful forces. Gravity, driven by the sheer mass of the star, wants to pull everything inward and crush it to a single point.
And the other force?
Nuclear pressure pushing outward. Deep in the core, gravity squeezes the hydrogen gas so tightly and heats it to such extreme temperatures that hydrogen atoms start to fuse into helium.
just like the Big Bang, but inside a star.
Exactly. And this fusion releases a colossal amount of outward energy. So as long as the star has hydrogen to burn, the inward crush of gravity and the outward push of fusion remain perfectly balanced.
Which is what our sun is doing right now, right?
Yes, our sun is happily converting hydrogen to helium at around 50 million degrees.
But the fuel tank isn't infinite. Eventually, a star has to run out of hydrogen.
And when a massive star depletes its hydrogen, that outward nuclear pressure suddenly drops.
So gravity wins.
Gravity immediately takes the upper hand and crushes the star even tighter. This intense squeezing drives the core temperature up from 50 million to 100 million degrees.
Wow.
At that extreme heat, the helium ash left over from the first phase ignites. The star begins fusing helium into carbon.
So it literally survives by burning its own waste products.
Exactly. And this triggers a cyclical accelerating process. The star forms concentric onion layers of fusion.
Onion layers.
Yeah, it runs out of helium, gravity crushes it further, the temperature spikes to 500 million degrees, and that carbon fuses into oxygen. Then oxygen fuses to neon.
It just keeps moving down the periodic table.
Right. Silicon, sulfur, all the way until the core starts producing iron.
And iron is the ultimate dead end for nuclear fusion, isn't it?
It is. Fusing iron requires more energy than it releases. So the moment a star's core turns to iron, the outward pressure vanishes instantly.
Oh, no.
Gravity wins the billion-year war in a fraction of a second. The entire mass of the outer star collapses inward, hits the solid iron core, and rebounds in one of the most violent events in the universe.
A supernova.
A supernova explosion.
Right.
And that explosion violently scatters all those heavy, life-giving elements across the cosmos to form new planets.
And eventually us. So what does this all mean? Phillips cracks a joke in the lecture. He says, "Have you hugged a star lately? You better have an asbestos suit on."
It's a great line.
But the reality behind the humor is staggering. Every heavy element around us was forged in the 500 million degree belly of a dying star and then blasted across the galaxy. We are literally walking, talking, recycled nuclear waste from exploded dead stars.
This raises an important question, though, about our place in all of this. Because while that is an incredibly humbling perspective, it shifts even further when you consider the overall makeup of the cosmos.
What do you mean?
Well, everything we just described, the protons, neutrons, electrons, the stars, planets, and humans, all of that is known as baryonic matter.
The stuff we can see and touch.
Right. But baryonic matter accounts for only 4.5% of the total mass energy of the universe.
Wait, we are just a 4.5% rounding error?
Essentially, yes. The vast majority of the universe is completely invisible and alien to us. Roughly 20% is dark matter, and about 73% is dark energy.
So we exist as this rare minority material in the cosmos.
Exactly. We are, as Phillips puts it in the lecture, special nobodies.
Special nobodies. I like that. And, you know, the lecturer notes a really interesting philosophical angle here.
Oh, right. The Easter egg hunt idea.
Yeah. He points out that some people look at this incredibly precise timeline. You know, the initial flash of light, the exact elemental ratios, the delayed lifting of the cosmic fog, and they see an Easter egg hunt designed by God.
Connecting the science to Genesis.
Right. He actually quotes an agnostic astronomer, Robert Jastrow, who observed how closely the astronomical timeline mirrors a sudden biblical creation event. And obviously, we're just reporting on the source material here, not endorsing a specific religious stance, but it's a fascinating look at how science and philosophy intersect.
It really is. And regardless of the philosophical lens you use, science tells us we are physically bound to the very fabric of the universe's history.
We are woven into the timeline.
Exactly. Phillips references the naturalist John Muir, who famously wrote that every flower is hitched to a star. And when you look at stellar nucleosynthesis, that isn't just poetry. It is rigorous chemical fact.
So, bringing all of this together, we have the threefold cord that Phillips says proves the Big Bang model, and which is not easily broken. First, the literal ongoing expansion of space itself, like raisin bread expanding in an oven.
Right. Second, the precise mathematical abundance of light elements. The hydrogen and helium forged in that strict 100-second to 3-minute window.
And third, the cosmic microwave background radiation. The 300,000-year afterglow from when the cosmic fog cleared, still ringing through our radio antennas today.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, there's something truly profound and honestly almost chilling about the era in which we happen to exist.
Okay, how so? Leave us with a mind-bending thought here.
Well, we established that the expansion of space stretched out the visible light of the Big Bang into microwaves over the past 14 billion years.
Right.
But that expansion is not slowing down, it's actually accelerating. If this expansion continues forever, space will keep stretching those wavelengths.
So it'll get even longer.
Exactly. Eventually, those microwaves will stretch into ultra-long, entirely undetectable radio waves.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which means that billions of years from now, any future civilizations or astronomers that evolve on distant planets could point their telescopes at the sky and find absolutely no trace of the Big Bang's embers.
The clues will just be gone.
They won't see anything. We just happen to live in a perfectly privileged temporary window of cosmic time where the universe is old enough to have formed heavy elements for life, but still young enough to tell us the story of how it was born.
If you show up too late to the fire, the ashes are gone.
Exactly.
We are just incredibly lucky to be here right now with telescopes that can still see the sparks. Thank you to you, the listener, for joining us on this deep dive. Keep looking up, keep asking questions, and we will catch you next time.